I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Arianna Huffington, co-founder of the Huffington Post, the news website. Arianna launched the Huffington Post in 2005, and the company was acquired by AOL in 2011. Also a prolific writer, Arianna has written more than a dozen books on topics including feminism, Maria Callas, Picasso, the Greek gods, and well-being. She's also been a talk show radio host, a wife of Congressman Michael Huffington, a candidate for governor of California, and she's a mother of two girls. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Jessica.
I'd like to start off with your early life, because in a way I think it helped to inform what you're doing now. Your mother was a Russian. She and her family moved to Greece after World War II, and your father was Greek. How did they meet?
So my mother was actually Greek from Russia. You know, they were like Greek refugees from Russia. Mm-hmm. And they met shortly after the Second World War when my mother was recovering from TB and had been told that she wasn't going to be able to have children. And my father was recovering from having spent the war in a German concentration camp because he had been publishing an underground newspaper during the German occupation of Greece. Mm-hmm. They fell in love, and she got pregnant.
You describe her as having Greek chutzpah, and you didn't have it easy. Your parents separated when you were 11 years old. Your father was a philanderer, and your mother supported you both. What did she do?
Yes, well, she basically had this incredible sense that we were not limited by circumstances. So she would borrow money. She had some support from her brothers. She had a lot of brothers. And we lived in a one-room apartment in Athens. But when I looked at a picture of Cambridge in a magazine when I was in high school and I said, I want to go to college there, and everybody else laughed, my mother said, well, let's find out how we can get you to Cambridge. And that was really her spirit.
And she picked you, the three of you up, and you moved to Cambridge upon your acceptance.
Yes. Well, my sister stayed in Athens until she completed high school, and then she went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in London. So the whole family, the three of us, moved to London. And I want to make it clear, we were close to my dad, who was sort of a brilliant intellectual and a journalist all his life. But having sort of survived the concentration camp, he had a sense that somehow life owed him and he didn't have to follow the standard rules.
When did your father die?
My father died actually just a few months before my mother, both of them in 2000.
We talk a lot about being influenced by your mother. What about your father, other than the fact that he ran an underground newspaper and there's that connective tissue in the journalism front? What other personality traits would you say are similar, even in your private moments?
Well, my father was a wonderful writer. He wrote a book, actually, about his experience in the concentration camp. And he kept starting newspapers, and they all failed. Maybe that's why I'm never going into print. But he definitely gave me that love of journalism, that love of actually even seeing something being produced. Mm-hmm. And he was a real intellectual. I mean, you could sit down and discuss Nietzsche and Schopenhauer with him. Mm-hmm. But he was also a serial philanderer. And when my mother complained, he told her not to interfere in his private life.
You mentioned that you went to Cambridge, although your first foray internationally was in the United States. When you were 15, you were an exchange student in York, Pennsylvania. What was 15-year-old Arianna Huffington like? How would those families in Pennsylvania describe you?
Basically, I had just started learning English. I'm sure my accent was even worse than it is now. But I loved people. I loved meeting new people. I was intensely curious, so I wanted to learn everything. I remember one day when they told me that they had set up a blind date for me, and I assumed that the guy was blind. And so I was being very solicitous and surprised that he could navigate his way so well for a blind man. So I learned a lot about American habits and jargon.
How about your sense of self? You are a self-starter and confident. And was that evident from even your teens?
I definitely wouldn't say I was super confident. Mm-hmm. I had this voice in my head that took me a while to actually deal with. When I write about in Thrive, I call it the obnoxious roommate living in my head. You know, that voice of self-doubt, of questioning. It was incredibly self-judgmental.
And then you had your mother to counter it.
Yes, and also gradually learning to deal with that voice and make sure that I knew that the voice wasn't the truth and the voice wasn't who I am.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Arianna Huffington, co-founder of the news website, The Huffington Post. I want to talk about your life post-Cambridge. The first love of your life, Bernard Levin. He was a British journalist, and you met on a game show. Can you describe that briefly?
It was a game show called Face the Music. It was like a classical music quiz. They would play a little piece of music and you would have to guess what it was. But before I met him, I had fallen in love with his writing, and I used to cut out his columns from the London Times and underline them and put them in files. Probably I might have had some pressed flowers in there. And so when I met him, I was very nervous. You know, he was twice my age and half my size. Mm-hmm. And he invited me for dinner 2 weeks later. And I literally spent 2 weeks prepping for dinner. Beautifying myself, but reading everything about all the topics he was writing about, Northern Ireland and the Soviet Union, etc. Anyway, we ended up together for 7 years, but he never wanted to get married, and he never wanted to have children, which was even more important because I was very clear I did want to have children.
And was a coincidence, you wrote a book, your I believe it was your second book or third book, it was a biography about Maria Callas.
Yes,
third
book.
It was striking to me the parallels between you and Bernard and Maria and Onassis. Was that in your mind at all when you wrote the book, how there's this profound love affair that you both, the four of you had, ended similarly?
Well, hers ended much more tragically because she actually did get pregnant, as I wrote in the book, with Onassis, and he convinced her to have an abortion. And on top of it, she died of a heart attack, truly of a broken heart, when he married Jackie Kennedy. In my case, I left when I was 30 and moved to New York. And, life is very mysterious. My whole life, everything that happened to me, my children, the Huffington Post being here, happened because a man wouldn't marry me, and I didn't trust myself to stay in London and not go back to him.
This move to New York, which really was a critical pivot moment personally and professionally, found you in Upper East Side society quite immediately. You and also your mother rented a townhouse on the Upper East Side.
Yes, my mother and I and my sister, we all moved together to New York to this beautiful townhouse that we rented. And my book on Maria Callas had been published and was a big success to everybody's surprise, including mine, because originally it was commissioned as a small opera story.
We're talking about your books. Your first book was called The Female Woman, which you wrote in 1974. You were 23 years old. It's striking your metamorphosis, the different stages that you have lived in your thinking. I don't know many people who have so publicly leaned into their initial views only to then write books or articles about such views that are on the other end of the spectrum, yet you've pulled it off.
Actually, everything I said in The Female Woman is what I still believe. I'm sure I would have written it better, and the language would have been different. But the principle of The Female Woman was in response to what was happening at the time, which was a period where women were only respected if they had a career, where women who chose to be mothers and were willing to make the financial sacrifices even were considered to be victims of social conditioning. There was a tremendous amount of anger at men. So The Female Woman was really a book which fully honored the feminist movement, fully honored, you know, the need for equal pay, equal opportunities, what I called in the book women's emancipation, as opposed to the what women's lib, quote-unquote, was at the time, which was an incredible glorification of the career woman.
Yet the reputation of it was that it was a conservative rebuke of the tenets of the feminist movement. But to your point, maybe the words could have been tweaked or restated.
I mean, I was 23. Yes, I'm sure I would hope they would be tweaked.
And I'm going to keep my 23-year-old writing under my bed. I'd like to talk about your life online. Your foray into online journalism was with a website called resignation.com, which called for the resignation of President Clinton. How did you go about launching the site? Because these are the early days of online.
Yes. Well, I basically felt that it was absurd to try and impeach a president for what he had done. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it was really unfair to drag an entire country through years of impeachment and basically taking our eye off the ball in terms of those left behind, the economy. And resignation.com was really a site about the importance of resignation as a political tool and how often throughout history it had been used for noble purposes, you know, to disagree with someone in your own party, to save a country from going through an unnecessarily challenging time, etc. And so that was really the purpose of the site. And I felt that so much of the conversation had started moving online. And I felt being able to have an ongoing discussion of a very important topic could only really be done online.
So it was as much, you thought, a strategic, logistical solution to have him resign versus be impeached,
right,
than a moral one.
Oh, yes, it was definitely a strategic one.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Arianna Huffington, co-founder of The Huffington Post. We'll hear more from Arianna coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Arianna Huffington, co-founder of the online media platform, The Huffington Post. Arianna launched The Huffington Post in 2005, and the company was acquired by AOL for $315 million in 2011. The Huffington Post won its first Pulitzer Prize for reporting in 2012, making it the first online-only news site to do so. Arianna has written more than a dozen books on topics ranging from Picasso to Greek mythology. Her most recent book, Thrive, is about well-being and what she calls the third metric. She's also been a talk show radio host, a candidate for governor of California, and she's a mother of two girls. And then there's Arianna Online, which was the precursor, in a way, to the Huffington Post. Can you describe that briefly?
Well, yeah, Arianna Online was really a site, the first site I launched that to deal with all my writing. And my mother even had a column that we called Ask Yaya, which is the Greek for grandmother. She would get a lot of questions about relationships. People would ask her questions, and she would literally sit at the kitchen table on a yellow pad and write the answers, and we would transcribe them and post them.
This is in the early days of the blogging and online citizen journalism. And did somebody teach you how to navigate online? Or
yes, absolutely. And I was very intensely curious about what was happening online, and I wrote a column which was really a love letter to the blogosphere. I remember at a bloggers convention, I was given an award for my support for the blogosphere. So in a way, when the Huffington Post was launched in 2005, part of what I wanted to do was to elevate the status of bloggers, because at the time, bloggers were caricatured, really, as people who couldn't get a job and they were living in their parents' apartment or basement and blogging in their pajamas.
Which there's nothing wrong with.
Nothing wrong with that. It's actually a great thing to do. But we brought in Arthur Schlesinger, Norman Mailer, Nora Ephron, and who had no hierarchy, so they could find themselves next to an unemployed teenager who had something interesting to say. And there was a quality test, you know, it wasn't a free-for-all. So it began to change our perception of bloggers.
Huffington Post was, a way, as you said, to elevate the blogosphere. You mentioned Arthur Schlesinger. Was he your first blogger, the historian?
He was the first person I reached out to. I reached out to 500 people who were friends, and he was the first because I thought he was such an amazing voice who had lived through the whole century, and I'm sure he was never going to be online unless it was made really easy for them, for people like him or Norman Mailer. And yet I would love to hear what he had to say about the issues of the day. And that's exactly what happened. I remember when President Bush at the time gave a speech that included something about the Yalta Agreement, and Arthur Schlesinger had been part of it, and he faxed me. He would fax me his blogs, why he disagreed with what the president had said, and we posted it. And it was really what I had wanted to achieve, to have like an instant conversation around the issues of the day.
To what extent was Kerry's loss, the presidential candidate John Kerry in 2004, a catalyst for starting the Huffington Post? It's been said anecdotally that it was almost an answer to the Drudge Report, which was this conservative venue. Can you speak to the catalyst for starting the Huffington Post other than wanting it to be a soapbox for bloggers?
So, you know, we had a lot of different elements that we wanted to bring together for the Huffington Post. One was a great platform for people, some well-known, some not, with interesting things to say and do it in real time. The other was an aggregation of news. And the third was original reporting. But these were sort of the three elements plus commenting that were sort of the essential elements of the Huffington Post at the beginning.
You brought in venture capital.
Not at the beginning.
In what way did bringing on capital help to change your thinking about what the Huffington Post could become? Because in the beginning, it was just a platform. And why does that need capital?
In the beginning, you know, my co-founder, Kenny Lehr, and I put in or raised the money to launch it. But then as we wanted to expand and grow faster, and we brought in SoftBank with the original infusion of capital.
Along with Oak being a
Oak
third round.
Oak was the third round. Fred Harman, who came in and joined our board in 2008. That was really a great moment. First of all, it was the time just when the financial world collapsed, when very few people were making investments. So it was really very brave of Fred to come in and invest in the Huffington Post over $20 million and make it possible for us to really develop a sales force, hire more journalists, and be able to grow in all the areas that we wanted to grow.
In what way is the success of Huffington Post also a technology story?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the Huffington Post is a media and technology company. I mean, we had a great CMS.
Content management system.
We had, from the beginning, dashboards available to editors that gave them instant feedback on how stories were doing. That made it possible for them to tweak headlines, to respond to readers, to be very connected with our readers and more our viewers too, because we started doing video.
Regarding the content, the management system, this allowed content to go viral and to focus on what was working almost in real time. This was innovative. And Jonah Peretti and Paul Berry, they were your technology gurus.
Yeah, Jonah was our first CTO. And then Paul was our CTO, and they were absolutely wonderful.
There was criticism when AOL bought the company, bought Huffington Post, that, well, citizen journalists weren't being paid, yet the shareholders of Huffington Post had a payday. It's not unique to Huffington Post. How do you reconcile the economics of citizen journalists not being remunerated for their work?
There are actually two elements to the Huffington Post and to many other sites. One is a journalistic enterprise where we have over 800 journalists, editors, reporters who are very well paid. In fact, we are pioneers at making sure that we have workplaces that are very sustainable with nap rooms and email policies that make it clear that employees are not expected to be on email once they're off work. And we are a platform. The platform is really an opportunity for people who have something to say and want to use it to have distribution, to have very wide distribution. They can use it or not use it. It's entirely their decision. And they're primarily bloggers. You know, when we talk about citizen journalists, we talk about our own reporters, say, writing a story, as David Wood did, the story of returning vets, for which we won the Pulitzer. And at the end of each story, he would invite the community of vets and their relatives and friends to write about it. Now, they would write because they wanted to tell those stories. Self-expression has become the new entertainment. A lot of people would rather update their Facebook entries, update Wikipedia, blog on the Huffington Post or their Tumblr account. They would rather do that than watch more television or do other things that they might have done in the past.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Arianna Huffington, co-founder of the news website, The Huffington Post. Going back to the early days of The Huffington Post, how much was your vision of The Huffington Post different from what it has become?
Oh, my vision of The Huffington Post was always about all the things that it has become. It was always about wanting to be a global media company, to bring our combination of journalism and a platform around the world. And in every country, we partner with the major media players there, like Le Monde in France or Asahi Shimbun in Japan. It's really great to see the same principle, you know, to have François Hollande, the president of France, next to a student in Paris writing about similar issues and having a conversation. So that was always my dream. I didn't know whether we would succeed, and I certainly didn't know how long it would take. But that's why at every stage I wanted to speed up the process, like taking more funding, which would dilute us, but make it easier for us to keep growing, or sell to AOL, which was really fabulous for the Huffington Post in terms of, again, having more resources available to grow faster.
And one of your investors, incidentally, in the early days was Lori David.
Yes.
Who is a friend of yours. And there's a story that you met. This is Larry David's former wife. She's an environmental activist. She said you walked up to her and said, "Can we hike?"
Oh, no, she was a good friend. We hiked 3 times a week. And on one of the hikes, we were discussing, you know, what we were doing, as we always did. And I mentioned this idea of the Huffington Post, and she said, "I mean." And she was, you know, our first investor. Mm-hmm. And when Larry and she got divorced, they kind of split the investment. A lot of my hiking friends became early bloggers. Another good friend, Kimberly Brooks, became our first arts editor. Mm-hmm. It was her idea to launch our arts section. Mm-hmm. I remember for the first year, we couldn't even pay her because we we were just using our resources to pay for the essentials. But she said, that's okay, I'll do it.
We talked about Schlesinger. From him, other bloggers came. And were there other catalysts that caused visitors to escalate, whether it was the technology innovation or advertising dollars? Was there one advertiser that really helped to open the floodgates for others? Or do you?
Yes, actually, Toyota was one of our first advertisers. They had this idea of asking me and then our readers to take pictures with our Toyota hybrid cars. Mm-hmm. So I took a picture with my Prius, which is what I was driving at the time, and then invited our readers to take pictures with their Prius or other hybrid Toyota car. There was a complete separation of church and state. I mean, we could cover Toyota in our business section the way we felt it was right to cover it. And then it led to another great advertising success when Johnson & Johnson came and we launched a dedicated section that they sponsored on their main cause, which was and continues to be global maternal health. And these sections have been another great revenue stream for the Huffington Post.
I want to switch gears and talk about your book, Thrive, which is about well-being. You write about a concept called the third metric. Could you describe what the third metric is?
So the third metric was born when I collapsed from exhaustion, sleep deprivation, and burnout and broke my cheekbone, got 4 stitches on my right eye. And it started me asking these questions like, what is success? And I looked around and I saw how in our culture we tend to define success simply in terms of these two metrics of money and power. And that, in fact, this is like a two-legged stool, and we need the third metric, which consists of our well-being, wisdom, wonder, and giving.
You have been meditating for quite some time. How long have you been meditating?
I started meditating when I was 13 because my mother was very, very interested in meditation and yoga. But I was an on-and-off meditator, and it was really after my burnout and collapse that I started meditating every day. And in the book, I recommend that people start with 5 minutes. It doesn't matter how short your meditation is at the beginning. And also, there is no bad way to meditate.
There have been scientific studies showing that meditating does impact the gray matter in your brain. What changes do you recognize having now been meditating?
Yes, I mean, the changes are remarkable. And you're right. I mean, the book has 55 pages of scientific endnotes because I wanted to make it very clear to the skeptics that this is not kind of new agey, flaky California stuff. This is real. This is modern science validating ancient wisdom.
You, by the way, have very good posture, Ariana. Where does that come from?
Well, I do yoga every day. Even when I'm flying, I kind of have certain yoga postures I can do on the plane. Mm-hmm. And I find that, again, the focus on the breath is really important, you know, in terms of how we sit and how present we are.
In addition to meditating, another component of the third metric is sleep. It's like the purloined letter, Edgar Allan Poe's short story. Everybody's looking. It's a detective story. Everybody's looking for the answer, and it's the stolen letter that's sitting and right in front of everybody. And I feel like sleep, it's such an obvious one, yet nobody gets enough sleep.
That is a great metaphor. It is the obvious thing that's right in front of us. And I recommend starting with getting 30 minutes more sleep than you are getting now, unless you're one of the few wise people who get all the sleep they need. And you know when you've gotten all the sleep you need because you wake up naturally without an alarm.
Did you have enough sleep last night?
Yes. I make a point. I would say, you know, I'm a work in progress like all of us. I don't do any of this perfectly. But I would say 90% of the time I get 8 hours sleep.
My husband and I, for fun, buy up URLs, and one that we own is supperby7.com, which basically is a corollary to what you're saying, which is have supper by 7 o'clock.
Yes, I love that.
If you eat right before bed, that's not good. And if you eat early enough, you could almost go to bed when the sun goes down.
Yes.
And how wonderful to wake up when the sun comes up. We are such a post-industrial society where we're living artificially by all these electric lights, causing such disequilibrium.
Absolutely. I love Supper by Seven. I think it really makes a big difference to allow some time after you eat. I also am a big believer in a transition between our wakeful life and our time asleep, whether it's 10 minutes to have a hot bath or a shower, read something that's not online. Mm-hmm. I mean, my bedroom is a device-free zone.
Do you carry around hard-boiled eggs with you? I read somewhere.
Yes, I kind of carry around food because I've eliminated certain food groups like sugar and gluten. And so I think I need to carry some things with me to avoid starvation when there's nothing else around.
It's funny because we all think, oh, here we are. We're the only one carrying a hard-boiled egg. But you know what? More people than not are doing such
yes.
things. What is your relationship to music?
Oh, I love music. I love classical music, and I mostly write with classical music on, Mozart especially, and or Strauss waltzes when I want to pick me up. But I also love country music.
Who would have known? How about Schumann's Fourth?
Schumann's Fourth was the answer I gave correctly, believe it or not, on the Face the Music quiz, where I was with Bernard Levitt when I first met him.
You talk about how a life that embraces a third metric is one that is aware of one's eventual eulogy. What will people say about you?
So this is so interesting, Jessica. I have zero interest in my legacy or what people say after my death, partly because I don't believe life ends with death. I see it more as kind of dropping off the rental car, which is our body, and flying off.
Your rental car, when you drop it off, Ariana, will have traveled many miles. Thank you for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Ariana Huffington. Coming up, we'll meet Scott Moody, co-founder of Authentic. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Jessica Harris, this is From Scratch. My guest is Scott Moody, co-founder of Authentic, a company that makes fingerprint sensors that could unlock mobile phones and computers. Authentic was sold to Apple in 2012 for $356 million, and the fingerprint sensor first appeared on the iPhone 5S in 2013. Scott is also the co-founder of K4 Connect, a company that helps users integrate disparate technologies into one platform. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Jessica. It's great to be here.
So you worked at Harris Semiconductor for 18 years. You had some colleagues who introduced the idea of a fingerprint sensor technology to you. Can you talk about that moment when you first came into contact with this idea?
There was a guy that worked for me, Nick Van Vano. He set up a meeting, wanted to introduce me to this other guy named Dale Setlack. You know, this was back a while ago, late 1990s, and I think we still wore suits or at least ties into work most days. And here comes Dale. You know, Dale has long hair in a ponytail. He's a little bit bald on top, and, you know, he's wearing a nose ring. And I'm just like, who is this guy? They presented this idea of a fingerprint sensor. I'll be honest, Jessica, I didn't really think it was a great idea. But Nick, who I knew exceedingly well, thought it could work. Dale convinced me he was an incredibly smart guy. And I really saw the whole idea of passwords starting to be a problem. So we actually started a research project around that very idea.
Was the biometrics area a busy place? I mean, you have companies creating products to read your eyes. How big was that space at the time?
So in terms of actual dollars that people were spending outside of government, it was exceedingly small. In terms of the people that said they could do something, there was a lot. There was probably 50 or 60 fingerprint sensor companies out there.
And what was it about your specific technology that made you think that you were different from those other companies?
We truly had a better technology. You know, technically, all of them really were looking at the surface layer of your finger. So if your finger was dry, or particularly if you were older, and actually had a number of issues. You know, as you get older, your skin becomes more supple. That's why we all have wrinkles. And so actually, when you put your finger down on a lot of the surface-based sensors, the ridges of your fingerprint would collapse into the valleys, and all you'd see was a big black blob. And so what we developed was something, at least at the time, we had brand named TruePrint. It was this RF, or radio frequency field, that read through the outer layer of your finger to your, what we referred to as your live layer, right, where your true fingerprint resides. In fact, if you sand down your finger to, you know, basically it's nice and smooth, it'll grow back exactly, you know, the same way.
While you were interested, finally, Harris Semiconductor, the company that you were all with, was not interested in pursuing the idea, and you licensed the technology from Harris and then started this on your own. Was that a tough conversation or separation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, first off, I was quitting a pretty good job to go start this other company. At the same time, Harris Corporation, the parent company, was exceedingly supportive. They actually helped fund the company to start.
Now, you had some failed demos. There are some stories of, you know, you're presenting to the chief technology officer at IBM and your technology not working. Can you provide one or two examples?
There's definitely demo hell, right? So the one you talked about, I was meeting with the CTO for IBM. So he sees the demo on the other side of the room. He puts his finger right down on the fingerprint sensor, and it says, "Hello, Dale Setlack." And, of course, is the co-founder and our CTO. So I was joking, like, you know, well, it recognized you as a CTO, you know. So incredibly embarrassing. There was another one with Phoenix Technology, the BIOS for PCs. We were in a very small room, and I was set it up on a separate table in the corner. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the system yells, "Access denied." And I'm telling you, it sounded so loud in that little room, and I ignored it. I was pretending like I didn't even see it. He's looking at me as I'm giving my pitch, like, is there something wrong? 2 minutes later, it does it again. So, of course, at that point, I had to admit there was a little bit of a problem. But you definitely feel, again, what people refer to as that demo hell.
Tell me briefly about just your impressions of raising capital.
Here's the thing about startups. Everybody tells you who funded the company. What they don't tell you usually is all the people that rejected you. So to me, raising money, honestly, is like the guy on the side of the road with a cardboard sign asking for money. 98% of the cars drive by and don't do anything. You know, 1.5% throw something at you or give you the finger. And 0.5% stop and give you money. You beg.
I want to talk about some of your early prototypes. Some of them didn't work very well. Can you tell me about that?
So, you know, when our first product came out, it didn't work, our first prototype. And I mean, it didn't not, like, work well. It, like, freaking didn't work. So that night we called the entire team together, and it was probably like 7 o'clock at night. I asked the question, how many people don't think we're going to make it? 20 people in the room, I think 15 of them raised their hands. And Jessica, I would have raised my hand, but I didn't think it would look good because I was the CEO, right? Talk about it, gave a rah-rah speech. And then, of course, as is important in any startup, we all went out and had some drinks. So the next day, come back in, we map out the plan, gave another rah-rah talk. And then again, we went out drinking. So that second night, I can remember going home. And I hardly ever talk about work at home. But that night, you know, I remember sitting down in our living room with my wife, and I was just like rambling on. I was just like, honey, I am so sorry. You know, I quit a good job. You know, we have the three kids. You know, I've ruined our life. I was just whining like crazy. And I'm pretty sure my wife probably said something in those 2 hours, but I don't remember it, right? Because I was so busy whining. But I do remember this, Jessica. It's like at the end of the conversation, my wife said to me, "You know what you need to do, so just go do it." You know, my wife could have turned around and said, "Yeah, you're right. You know, we need the money. You know, go get a job." but she didn't. Had she not said that night, Authentec may not have gone forward. So it was an incredibly important moment in my life.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Scott Moody, co-founder of Authentec, the company that made the fingerprint scanning technology on your Apple iPhone. You worked a lot with dermatologists in developing the technology. How are they helpful to you?
Really, the whole idea was to understand the various conditions of the skin. What I really gained experience on was outside, let's say, the dermatologist and actually testing. So we would go to construction sites, right, to test, you know, people that were used to working with their hands because they're all scarred up. They may be worn down. We would go to retirement communities. We would go to a lot of different places where, you know, there were populations that maybe have, you know, a different finger than I did as, you know, back then.
Before you and Apple connected, you were focused on not just the iPhone or the mobile phone market, but computers. And what other instruments were you looking to get this technology integrated in?
So in the beginning of the company, we really had this idea, look, let's go develop the technology. And it has application in a lot of different markets. It can be, you know, for automotive, PCs, cell phones. But when we really saw that the PC market was taking off and then the cell phone market, we generally stopped paying attention to those other markets.
Now, you chose the PC market at a time, though, when people were not maybe spending as much money for PCs, because this is during 2008, right?
All of a sudden, high-end PCs disappeared. And for us, the challenge was that was our market, these, you know, generally over $1,000 high-end PCs. And if you remember, you know, the beginning of 2009, those weren't selling.
So then how did you pivot then from your market, which at the time was high-end PCs, to then mobile phones?
Really, the people that got us our start in mobile and really for the whole company in terms of the largest first orders was Docomo and Fujitsu out of Japan. The big issue, frankly, Jessica, was is that our fingerprint sensor was ugly. If you know, you literally could see and touch the fingerprint sensor. So the big focus when the downturn hit was if we really wanted to get into smartphones, aesthetics was incredibly important. And we started on this whole idea of how do we cover up the fingerprint sensor, right? So that you don't really see it and it aesthetically matches with the phone. And so I think really that gave us a big push, right, to eventually be acquired.
You went public in 2007, which was a big moment for you. I mean, here you are, a guy from New Jersey, and here you are ringing the bell at NASDAQ with your wife and three daughters. Can you talk about that moment for a second?
So it was freaking cool. When you take a company public, it's kind of like winning the Super Bowl. My daughters actually rang the bell to open the stock exchange. And, you know, every time I even say that or think about it, I get a little tingle, and I just had one. That was a great thing to share, you know, with my wife and daughters. And, of course, the team as well and their families who also came up.
When did you get on to Apple's radar screen?
Look, it's funny because people ask me how long does a design win take?
What does that mean? The design
win? Actually, the OEM or the customer saying, we will design in your product. So the honest answer is anywhere between about 3 months and 14 years. In the Apple case, look, I met with them in 1998. I don't even remember who. And then, of course, in 2012, they acquired us. And a year later, it came out in their, I guess, the iPhone, you know, 5S. So that, what's that, 14-year design in.
When you presented it in 1998, you probably were thinking about it for Apple computers.
No, that's exactly right. Because the iPhone nor the smartphones really, as a category, existed in 1998.
Authentec was sold to Apple in 2012, but you didn't know what they were going to use the technology for. And it wasn't until Apple made the public announcement that they had this new touch sensor in their phone that you found out that it was in the phone.
Yeah, right? I had no idea. I mean, obviously, Apple's a very confidential company. They certainly didn't share their secrets with me. And so I was just like everybody else. And let me tell you, that was, like, that was really cool. That was just probably as good as the IPO. And I didn't probably realize how big it was, like, of an announcement until my phone just blew up. Text, phone calls, emails, congratulations and great job. Really, I had nothing to do with the iPhone 5S or the Touch ID. I can remember a text from my daughter, my oldest daughter, who texted me something. I'm going to paraphrase, it's not exactly right, but it was something like, "Dad, how's it feel to, you know, really, you know, change the face of mobile technologies?" From a girl that, you know, it wasn't that much earlier that she really didn't like me too much. That was neat.
You started off as the CEO and then stepped down. How was that for you personally? I see that a lot, you know, with founders having to step aside from a leadership role, and some take it gracefully, like, yeah, there's a better guy to lead this, and some take it, you know, a little more as a punch in the stomach. Like, where are you on that spectrum?
I was incredibly happy when Larry took over. I was burnt. I was completely burnt. And really, we had hired Larry, or I had hired Larry, who it took me 6 months to recruit into the company. Hired him before he went to the IPO, really with the idea that not long after the IPO, he would replace me. And I didn't really much like being a public company CEO. But that's when the 08, 09 downturn happened. So, you know, frankly, the board didn't want me to go, and Larry didn't really want to take over about right then. Mm-hmm. So I committed to, you know, stay a couple of years later. As part of another acquisition, it was really great that Larry stepped in.
Why do you think you were so burned out? I mean, is it just like inherent in a startup and an IPO and all of that energy and challenge that comes with that?
Yes. And it's like, you know, you finish this marathon and somebody's, "Well, hey, would you mind starting another marathon?" And then you finish that marathon, and it's like, "Look, you know, I'll give you 5 minutes rest, but do you mind doing this other marathon?"
I want to talk about your upbringing for a moment. You grew up in New Jersey. What did your parents do?
So actually, my father worked here in New York for a number of years. Unfortunately, in 1972, he was laid off from his job, ended up working in some bars, and eventually my parents were able to acquire their own bar.
What was he doing that he was laid off?
So he was, he was in technology, but if you consider technology typewriters at the time. So he was in a sales of typewriters.
There's a story that your dad, after he was laid off, pretended to go to work because he didn't want his children to know that he was laid off.
I can remember not only that experience with my father, but, you know, certainly back in that generation where they didn't want to admit something like that. Mm-hmm. So I can remember when he first told, you know, my mother. I can remember driving, you know, a couple neighborhoods over or towns over to go to a grocery store because my parents were using, you know, food stamps at the time and they didn't want us to see it. So I had great, you know, incredibly loving parents that really taught me well. They just fell on hard times.
I read about your father in a blog post that you wrote. This was on the eve of your having surgery for a brain tumor in spring of 2015. How did you even find out that you had a brain tumor?
I was having hearing issues, and then I felt a facial tick. Really just went to an ear doctor. If you're going to have a brain tumor, I had a good one, you know, in that it was actually not in my brain. It was just up against my brain.
And you found out that you had this tumor right when you were starting your new company, and you had just returned from a trip to Rwanda, which was the inspiration for starting your new company. So a lot going on.
I had retired after, you know, Apple acquired the company. I told you I was burnt out. I was never going to work again. Went to Rwanda. I had been there before on mission trips. During the tour and the visits with various entrepreneurs in Rwanda, I met this woman. So I'm talking to her, and, you know, she had gone over right after the genocide, eventually opened up 15 different orphanages, started baking cakes for the kids for their birthday. Next thing you know, she's opening a bakery and baking cakes for people all over Kigali. And then she bought this coffee shop, and she only employed battered women. I mean, it's like, geez, how great can your story be? She was talking about expanding her coffee shop, and she said, "I could use the proceeds from this to further God's will in other ways." So I went back to my wife. I was done being burnt out. I wasn't dead yet, had plenty of energy. And that was the whole idea that, look, let's, if we start another company and it is successful, we don't want the money. In fact, it would be embarrassing, but we could use it.
you could fund these projects in Rwanda.
And other places, right? So, you know, that was really the motivation for K4 Connect.
This is sort of like the Internet of Things there. Where
it's exactly the Internet of Things. So it's this whole idea of integrating various devices and systems into, to me, a system that's responsive to my needs.
Your first product still specifically with senior citizens and people with disabilities. And what was the catalyst for that specifically?
As I was really looking at where we were going to apply the technology, and actually I was meeting with this guy on a completely different subject at a coffee shop. He had reached out to me on homelessness. And so after talking about his advocacy, he asked me what we did. And I told him, and it turns out he has MS. And he used a cane, but I didn't know it because he was at the coffee shop before I was, and it was under the table. As I introduced the subject, Eric stopped me and he said, look, let me tell you guys why this is important to me. He says, the way I look at my day is when I wake up in the morning, I figure I have the energy for 1,000 good steps in my day. And how I use those steps defines the quality of my life. And then he pointed at us and he said, you guys can make my life better. And so, Jessica, I'll tell you, you know, for me, on a very personal level, it was an oh God moment. Like, if I felt called to start another company in Rwanda, like, it was unbelievably freaking clear to me at that moment that that's why.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jessica. I really appreciate your time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest has been Scott Moody, co-founder of Authentic. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.